measure. Tell me what Pharaoh commands. Be quick.
Wait, I will, but loose me.
A slight wrench on her wrist turned the plea into a gasp of pain. She tumbled the words out.
He asks if your magic be a shield and a buckler to you. Amun help you. You must rob the dead.
Go on.
He said, there is one alone in all of Egypt who will give gold gladly for his sake. You must find this one by the dark river. You must take what is his, even to the royal cobra and the collar of amulets. Aye, mother of the gods, loose me, Sheftu.
This is all.
Aye, all, I swear it.
The pressure on her wrist eased. She leaned against him, trying to steady her breathing. After a time, his arms dropped, and he moved a few steps away. But when he spoke at last, it was in his usual ironic voice.
Must I always drag my messages out of you by brute force? It promises to be wearing.
She raised her head. In the dim moonlight, his features were composed, if a trifle set.
You are not disturbed by this one?
It was not entirely unexpected.
I see. She breathed. Then you intend to obey?
Blue-eyed one, that is none of your affair.
But she knew the answer.
You're a fool, she whispered. 10,000 kinds of a fool, to risk your soul among the Hefs. They'll steal away your Ka and leave naught but the shell of you. They'll dwell in your shadow. They'll bring you down to blindness and sickness. They'll deliver you to the 40 beasts.
Her voice cracked and she broke off.
You tell me nothing I do not know,
said Sheftu softly.
Save one thing. Why are you so troubled about my fate?
She stopped and drew a long breath. I am not troubled.
You are close to tears.
Mara turned away from him, rubbing her sore wrist.
Not I. If you choose to be a reckless fool, it's not to me.
As he said nothing, she whirled back defensively.
I speak truth.
Do you?
I do.
He pulled her back into his arms, quite differently this time.
You never spoke truth in your life, he muttered. But speak it now. Why do you weep for me?
Mara's heart was beating fast. He was going to kiss her. It was inevitable this time.
Perhaps for the same reason you threatened to feed my poor Reshed to the crocodiles, she whispered.
She waited, scarcely breathing. Sheftu, were you afraid I might keep that bargain? His arms loosened suddenly, and the old, faintly mocking amusement returned to his voice.
Nay, I was afraid you might lose your entry in and out of the palace, he said lightly. Aye, aye, what a lovely hussy you are. This poor Reshed, I pity him. What will become of his illusions when he finds you out?
Mara jerked away, furious.
Only what should become of them? He must learn sometime not to believe every maid who weeps on his shoulder.
Aye, so he must, agreed Sheftu dryly. Go now. Nekank is waiting.
Without further farewell, he turned and strode rapidly toward the inn. Chapter 14 Shadow of the Dead. There was nothing of the simple scribe about Lord Sheftu as he sat at breakfast the next morning on the roof loggia of his villa on the street of Sycamores in western Thebes. He was clad in a dressing gown of royal linen, girdled with scarlet leather, and beside his chair was a table of carved Lebanon cedar bearing fruit, bread, cheese, and a lily-twined flagon of milk. A Cushite slave hovered in the background. Beyond the balustrade stretched the ample groves, gardens, and stables of Sheftu's town estate. They were extensive, but not so extensive as his ancestral holdings downriver, were acre upon acre of farmland, vineyards, pastures, orchards, grain fields, poured their riches every year into his storerooms and purse. It was a monthly accounting of those riches that was being read to him now by the old man in an elaborate wig who stood beside the balustrade. Irunamon, major domo of the entire domain since long before the death of Sheftu's father, Menkau.
From your lordship's diaries near the village of Nereb, 30 pounds of cheese, both white and yellow, and 20 beef for slaughter.
Irunamon's voice was like the rustling of a dried palm frond.
In addition, 100 skins of wine have been brought up river on your lordship's barge, Hour of Sunset, to be stored in your lordship's warehouses in the city of Thebes.
But his lordship was not thinking of beef or wineskins, nor was he showing much appetite for the array of dainties on the golden platter beside him. While his long fingers crumbled the bread and toyed absently with the fruit, his mind was far away, in the desolate wastes of the Valley of the Tombs of the Kings. In one of the barren gullies of that wilderness was a certain pile of red granite boulders. It looked the same as the other piles tumbled here and there through the valley, as if at the whim of a destructive giant. But to Sheftu, it was not the same. Far below it, in vast and silent chambers, hollowed out of the living rock, slept the one whose peace he must destroy, whose wealth he must steal, whose ka he must impoverish. The dread of it had lain like a stone on his mind since he had dragged that message out of a reluctant Mara. Though he had not let her see it, he hated and feared his task with all his heart. But it was not the crime she thought it, nor was it certain the guardian Hefs would rend his soul or even strike him blind. For there was one thing Mara had not known when she stormed and pled with him, and that was the identity of the royal slumberer. He was Thutmose the First, father of the king, and of Hatshepsut. In life, his arrogant daughter had robbed him of his throne when he was ill and feeble. Would he not willingly be robbed once more in death, if his gold could overthrow her? The prince had vowed he would, and Sheftu believed. He had to believe, because otherwise... Sheftu shook away that otherwise, along with the memory of Mara's predictions as she clung to him in fear. Whatever the Hefs might do, he had no choice but to descend into the tomb and come out laden. This was the last great gamble he and Thutmose had agreed on long ago, and the time had come to try it. Everything else that could be done was done.
Therefore, if the grain remained in the warehouses until such time as... I fear your lordship is not listening.
Sheftu pulled his attention back to old Irunamon's reproachful voice.
Aye, tell me that last again, please. According to the calculations of our river experts, who are never wrong,
repeated Irunamon patiently,
this year's inundation will be a small one, resulting in poor crops and a scarcity of grain in the months to come before Mother Nile again sends her gift to Egypt. Therefore, if a portion of your lordship's wheat still in the warehouses were to remain there, it would command a far greater price next summer in the time of hunger.
I understand. Save it, by all means, against the time of hunger. But do not raise the price, Irunamon. The people must eat, whether they can pay or not.
As your lordship wishes.
Irunamon cleared his throat and rustled the papyrus.
However, we, sell much grain to the agents of Her Majesty for the palace kitchens.
Sheftu shot a glance at the blandly innocent old face and hid a smile.
Charge what the buyer can pay. I leave it to your discretion.
The old servant bowed and went on with his lists without further comment. But Sheftu knew that a fresh stream of gold from Hatshepsut's treasuries would soon be pouring into his coffers. Unless, indeed, The treasuries belong to Thutmose by next summer. He felt a tremor of emotion at the thought. After 6 long years, it was hard to believe that the end of all this was approaching. Yet the plans he and Thutmose had made so long ago were almost complete, the work almost finished. Hatshepsut's elaborate structure of power was now like a house set upon columns of sand. Enlisting Hofra to gain control of the army had further weakened the foundations. There remained only a few lords still stubbornly loyal to the queen, out of fear for their own fortunes and futures. These must be won over by persuasion, and by Gold, the greatest persuader of them all. Sheftu smiled grimly, tossing bread to the pigeons strutting along the balustrade. His regard for his fellow man was not what it had been 6 years ago. He no longer believed, even in his heart, that there lived man or woman gold could not buy. Only their prices differed. These last cautious ones would cost a pharaoh's fortune, and a pharaoh must supply it. He who slept beneath that pile of boulders in the valley of the tombs of the kings. His thoughts had come full circle, for the 20th time that morning. Sheftu left his chair abruptly, and the pigeons scattered with a drumming of wings. Eranamon stopped reading, then began to roll up his papyrus.
"My lord wearies of business," he said tactfully. "Indeed, the morning is too fine for it. Hi, when I was your age. Shall I have the boat and the throw sticks ready to divert you?"
"Nay, old friend, I've no time for hunting. But I pray you, let us finish these accounts another time. I must drive to the temple within the hour. Go below and tell the barber to make ready for me."
As the old man turned toward the stairs, Sheftu laid an apologetic hand on his shoulder.
"Forgive my inattention, faithful one. I have much on my mind."
Eranamon's face lighted hopefully.
"Indeed, can it be that my lord has perhaps met some young lady?"
"Young lady?" With some difficulty, Sheftu achieved a careless smile.
"Patience, Eranamon. Some day, I promise thee, my mother's long empty place at the table will be filled. But at present,
aye, get thee gone now."
"Young lady." Turning irritably as the majordomo hobbled down the stairs, Sheftu signaled the slave to pour him a cup of milk. But even the lotus twined about the flagon brought to mind 2 mocking eyes, blue as enamel under slanted brows. Why, in Amun's name, must he think so continually of that waif? For a waif she was. Remember the marketplace at Menfi? Remember her waking on the boat, a smudge on her face and wild defiance in her pose? Yet, a dozen times a day, he found himself thinking of the fluid way she walked, dwelling, fascinated on some elusive curve of her cheek or throat, becoming preoccupied with the shape of her mouth. Aye, and remembering, far too vividly, the yielding warmth of her in his arms. Osiris, he had all but made love to her last night in the tavern courtyard, all but forgotten she was an unprincipled little vagabond bound to him only by a threat and a bribe. He must not forget. The maid could worm secrets from the Sphinx himself. His lordship set the cup down hard and descended the stairs. The devil. He had talked too much last night. Why not admit it? He, Sheftu, the discreet. She knew far more than he had ever intended her to know. Yet he'd had to fight the urge to keep talking. "Have you not learned," he asked himself caustically, "not to trust every maid who weeps on your shoulder?" He walked down a corridor and through a richly furnished sitting room, as blind to their sunny, familiar comfort as he was deaf to the greetings of a couple of house slaves who wished him good morning as he passed. How easy it would have been, there in the moonlight, to throw away all caution, to hold her tight in his arms and whisper that she must not fear.
No hefts would harm one who came only to carry the dead king's gifts to his living son. To tell her even the name of the royal slumberer and the place where he lay. Sheftu went cold at the thought. Had the maid bewitched him? That he would court destruction merely to dry her tears? He must come to his senses. He was acting as witless as that handsome young sentry of hers.
But I fear I misunderstood. Does my lord wish me to return later?
Sheftu swung around. He was standing in the middle of his own apartments, but had no more recollection of arriving there than he had of the presence of the barber, though the fellow must have spoken before. He collected his wits with some difficulty, cursing Mara and his own befuddled senses.
"Nay, I want you now, Thoth,"
he muttered, stripping off his dressing gown.
"Prepare your razors at once. I'm in haste."
The feel of the cooling salves and the razor sliding over his chin restored a sense of normality to the day, and he was grateful for the barber's silence, which enabled him to compose himself. As the fragrance of sandalwood from the last lotion rose on the air, Sheftu stood up, running a hand over his jaw.
"You are expert as ever, Thoth. Send my dresser in at once, and tell one of the grooms to harness Ebony and Wind of Swiftness to my lightest chariot."
10 minutes later, Lord Sheftu spun out of the courtyard and down the street of sycamores toward the river. Plumes tossed above his horse's sleek black heads, the sunlight flashed from his gold collar, and from 1,000 bits of colored glass set into the spokes of his chariot wheels. Driving off the ferry into the crowded streets of eastern Thebes, he flung a handful of coppers to the expectant throng of waterfront urchins, then turned into the Avenue of Sphinxes, which bisected the city and brought him straight through the tall bronze gates of the Temple of Amun. He stepped down, looking for someone to hold the horses. The huge courtyard swarmed with beggars, hurrying priests, white-clad Thebans buying frankincense and temple offerings from the hawkers whose booths lined the walls. Sacrificial fowl squawked and fluttered in their cages. Lambs bleated plaintively. The smell of dust, animals, and sacred unguents mingled with the fragrance of a mass of fresh lilies on a flower seller's stall.
"Hi! Rejoice, master!"
An old peddler had spotted him, set down his tray of consecrated bread, and hurried forward to catch the horse's reins. Tossing him a few deben, Sheftu made his way through the crowd and into the vast, columned corridors of the temple proper. He found the priest he sought in a tiny anteroom off the Shrine of Hathor. Jedet was a calm, portly man, with a face like a moon, wearing the leopard skin of the Sem rank over his white linen robes. He was tying up onions into the hollow, circular bunches proper for the offering table, but at sight of Sheftu, he paused.
"Your lordship, rejoice!"
He came forward at once, beckoning a subordinate to take over his task.
"There is some matter in which I may serve you?" "Aye. It concerns the mortuary shrine of my father's tomb. I wish to increase the number of loaves and honey jars left for his ka each month. And in addition..."
"A 1,000 pardons, my lord. Pray come into more comfortable quarters, that I may offer you refreshment. My private chamber will serve."
Sheftu followed the solid, stately figure out of the anteroom and down a hall lined with columns so massive they made even Jedet seem fragile as a splinter. Once the door of the little room had closed firmly behind them, the priest's impassive manner vanished.
"Is it the signal? Shall I order the—"
"Nay, my friend. The time is not yet. Indeed, the time will never be unless you and I can perform one last impossibility."
Sheftu sighed, the heaviness of his dread settling over him again.
"Sit you down, Jedet. I will tell you what we must do."
The priest's round face grew graver and graver as he listened. When Sheftu had finished, the little room was silent.
Then Jedet rose ponderously and walked to the table, where he stood staring down at a pile of scrolls.
"You have a plan?"
he muttered.
"Aye. We will need 2 diggers, men we can trust to be silent. Ashur can find them. And to ensure their silence, after the task is done, I will send them to my farthest estate, to live in luxury and solitude, until it is safe to loose them. I know a river captain who will arrange all that. As for your part, you must obtain the royal seal."
Jedet swung around, eyes bulging.
"But I cannot do that. Only the High Priest of the City of the Dead."
"I know. But you must accomplish it somehow. Listen."
Jedet listened, his expression changing slowly. He moved back to his chair and sank into it, his face intent, his voice low as he put a question or two. At last he nodded.
"I think it can be done, unless the guards at the valley..."
He chewed his lip a moment, then shrugged heavily.
"Aye, the plan is shot through with danger. But what is not these days? Better we die, my lord, than Egypt."
He rose, touching forehead and chest.
"I will do my best and send word. May the gods be with us."
"Better we die than Egypt," repeated Sheftu to himself as he walked slowly back down the corridor. His eyes moved to the columns, rising close-set and massive on either side, stretching up and up until their carvings were lost in the dim reaches far above him. Old beyond memory, they were, like Egypt itself, and they would stand unchanged 1,000 years more. Aye, and so would Egypt, no matter who had to die. One death alone would be enough, thought Sheftu grimly, that of a bejeweled and willful queen. He turned a corner and strode along a passage, neither noticing nor caring where it led. A few moments later, roused by the faint, irregular beat of hammers, he stopped and looked around him. Scowling, he realized he had strayed into the north wing. Not since last summer had he come to this place, and he had sworn then he would never come again. Slowly, he pivoted to his left. There, only a few paces distant, was the entrance to the hall the first Thutmose had built as his kingly gift to the god. Sheftu walked toward it, his face set, the tap-tap of goldsmith's hammers growing louder in his ears. At the tall doorway he stopped, looking into a huge room flooded with sunshine. There, in the middle of the roofless hall, stood the queen's new obelisks. They were no nightmare then, but 700 tons of solid reality, monstrous needles of stone 97 feet tall, soaring straight up into the brilliant sky. Sheftu's gaze traveled their length, part of which was at the moment obscured by scaffolding upon which gold workers swarmed. Well, he remembered the day last summer those shafts came floating down the river from the quarries, on a flotilla of linked barges that seemed to stretch back to Nubia. No man had ever seen their like, for they had been cut from single blocks of granite, without a seam or a joint, and, because the queen was impatient, in only 7 months' time. There was an inscription on them swearing to it. How, in Amun's name, had mortal hands accomplished it? It was all but impossible. So was raising the obelisks here, within the temple itself. But here Hatshepsut wanted them, and here they stood. Though it had been necessary to tear out many of her father's beautiful cedar columns and the whole roof of the hall to make room for them. Bitterly, Sheftu stared at the wreckage, remembering the crack of the lash and the ant-like swarm of men straining on ropes, dropping, dying, being trampled by their fellows as with a shuddering slow movement, the great shafts rose into place, monuments to Hatshepsut's pride and malice. And now, Sheftu's eyes moved to the scaffolding, through which a growing surface of pale yellow glittered in the sun. Furiously, he turned and strode back toward the courtyard, the faint tapping of the goldsmith's hammers following him. Through the sound, he could hear again Hatshepsut's voice.
"My majesty is not pleased. The obelisks are mere dull stone, and so unworthy of the daughter of the sun. I desire that they reflect Ra's beams from every surface. They shall be cased in electrum."
Extravagance upon extravagance, until the very gods must be outraged. She would bring ruin upon the Black Land. The temple's dim quiet ended abruptly as Sheftu stepped into the noise and dust and mingled odors of the outer courtyard. It was like plunging into another element, and the shock steadied him and dissipated his wrath.
"Fool, anger gets you nowhere," he told himself, as he gathered his horse's scarlet reins and popped the whip over their flanks.
"Let her have her obelisks. She will soon have nothing else. As for the task ahead, think no more of it now. Jedet will arrange all. You have nothing to do but wait." Chapter 15. The Signal. But waiting was hardest. A day dragged by, then another, without word from the priest. Sheftu had spoken to Ashur early. The diggers were arranged for and waiting, though they knew not what their task was to be. Nekonk was waiting, the beetle provisioned and ready to spirit the men away. The king was waiting for word, Mara waiting to carry it, Sheftu waiting, in a torment of suspense, to act. For the first time in 6 years, the wheels of his secret life had ground to a dead halt. All plans hinged on one now, and that one hung like an unanswered question on the air, growing hourly more urgent. It was all Sheftu could do to grace the court of Hatshepsut with unchanged serenity, to behave as usual under the eyes of his household. Hardest of all was to hide from Mara the strain he was feeling, to parry her questions and then laugh at her anger. Each night she came to the inn for news, and he could tell her nothing. Their conversations were like duels. Rather than dreading the task which still hung over him, he now began to long for it, that the issue might be settled. Inactivity ached like a tooth. Soon after noon, on the fourth day, restlessness led him down to the barracks of the queen's bodyguard, whose quarters and parade field occupied a large open area to the rear of the palace grounds. He found Khofra sitting on a hard chair in his severe and cell-like quarters, waiting for the bugle which would summon him to his afternoon inspection of the troops.
"Come in, my lord, come in,"
the old man greeted him, waving to a second and even harder chair.
"Sit down and test the rigors of military life, though I promise this is luxury compared to what those poor devils on the parade grounds yonder call their own. Aye, well, there's no other way to make soldiers of them. Hard chairs, hard beds, hard fighting."
"And a general as hard as they," suggested Sheftu, sitting down. Khofra gave his soundless laugh.
"Aye, they look up to me. Knowing I've slept on rocky ground oftener than they've slept in their couches. They're coming on, Lord Sheftu. They're shaping up. Someday we'll have an army here instead of a crowd of idlers. But I warn you."
The old general lowered his voice, and his face grew grim.
"I've promised them action. Campaigns, foreign battlefields, victories like those we knew in the old days, for the glory of Egypt. Take care you produce them." "Never fear. There'll be action in plenty once Thutmose takes command. By the feather, our empire's in a sorry mess, Haut Khofra."
Sheftu got up and began to pace.
"Every week a new dispatch comes in. There's another uprising in Nubia, a bad one, and an outbreak on the border farther north. Worse yet, the king of Kadesh has stirred up every city king in northern Palestine and Syria. They're banding together to defy us, and the queen does nothing, nothing. Our governors are going frantic. They need more men, more gold. They need it. So do I, Bayaman. Yet she's even taking what I have."
Sheftu stopped.
She's doing what?
Reducing my forces, cutting down allotments, refusing to fill my orders for supplies.
You didn't know this?
By the Devourer, no!
He listened with growing fury as Khofra explained. The bodyguard, normally 2,000 troops, had been reduced by a third even before Khofra had assumed command. In the past 2 weeks, 100 more had been dismissed, and the pay for those remaining was already 5 days late.
Then about the helmets, Khofra growled. A week ago I sent in a requisition for 200 archers' helmets of scarlet leather, well padded and quilted, with a good gold fringe. I needed 300, but some of the old ones will serve, though they be shabby enough. This morning the requisition came back. Refused. Perhaps she means to send the archers into battle bareheaded? Something must be done.
Something will be done, snapped Sheftu. Now, at once, what of the regular army, those not of the bodyguard? How badly have they dwindled?
By more than half. And as for chariots and horses,
Khofra threw up his hands.
That will be the task of our prince, said Sheftu.
He'll build the regulars up soon enough, once we've set him on his throne.
But to set him there, we need the bodyguard, full strength and well-equipped. And by Amun, we'll have it.
Who rules on these requisitions?
My lord Nahere, master of armories and of the white storehouse for linen. He of the face like a chip of granite. He doles out the pay, too, when there is any.
Nahere, said Sheftu thoughtfully. Brother of the architect himself.
A man to be reckoned with. Sheftu knew him only too well. It was not the first time that a stony face had stood between him and his goal. He dropped into a chair.
He's Senmet's right hand, Haut Khofra, and Senmet's the queen's. Obviously, she needs the gold elsewhere, for some new extravagance.
Was not her last one folly enough?
Snorted Khofra.
I mean the two obelisks, gods of Egypt. How does the woman conceive these things? Single blocks, unmarred by joints or even chisel marks.
That was merely the beginning,
remarked Sheftu dryly. He mimicked.
The obelisks are mere dull stone and so unworthy of the daughter of the sun. I desire that they reflect. By my Ka!
He burst out suddenly.
There's her need for gold. Did you know, Haut Khofra, that she is casing the shafts in electrum?
Khofra's shaggy eyebrows soared.
Those man-made mountains? Impossible.
Aye, our queen is fond of the impossible. Gold and silver over every inch of those monster slabs. I saw them at work on it myself only a few days ago. By this time, I'll wager, they're working up near the roof and Egypt's treasury's nigh empty.
Small wonder she needs funds.
Sheftu was on his feet, stalking about the bare little room.
She'll not steal them from the bodyguard. Look you, my general. It's clear how this came about. The queen fretting for more gold, the architect, as usual, scheming out a solution.
Most glorious majesty, why feed and clothe 2,000 idle soldiers in time of peace? Riff-raff eating their bellies full at your radiance's expense. And it is my brother Nahere who holds the purse strings.
Aye, he'll wish he'd held his peace.
Sheftu paused beside his chair, fingers drumming upon its back. A smile was beginning to curve the corners of his mouth.
But what can you do?
Put in Khofra. I can see the queen. I can inform her with the gravest concern of the bodyguard's condition. I can thank Amun repeatedly and loudly that I discovered the situation before it was too late.
You mean she doesn't know of it?
Of course she knows. But, my general, if I behave like one saving her from disaster, she will not admit she knows. She will first try to find out what is so wrong with Senmet's little scheme.
And what will you tell her?
Shaftu smiled.
Haut Khofra, her radiance, the daughter of the sun, fears one thing only, the loss of her throne. Suppose it were suggested to her that Senmut's motives might not be pure, that he might have reasons to wish her bodyguard depleted, her protection undermined.
She would never believe it, not of her precious architect.
No. Do you remember Nesse, who commanded her great expedition to Punt a few years back? Do you remember Thuti, once Lord High Treasurer? And Neb-Iri, only recently Grand Overseer of her temple? Whatever happened to those great favorites of hers, Haut Khofra? Strange how they have dropped out of sight forever.
Khofra shot a sidelong glance at him.
I know nothing of such matters, my lord, but I do know these men commanded projects close to her heart. She has never taken a moment's interest in her bodyguard.
She is about to begin, retorted Shaftu.
I'll wager you a gold chain, my general, that an hour from now the palace bodyguard will have become the consuming interest of Hatshepsut's life, and Senmut an unhappy man.
Khofra's skeptical old eyes met Sheftu's across the room, and gradually the doubt cleared away from them. He chuckled, and as the shrill blast of a bugle pierced the silence, he rose, buckled on his quilted cuirass, and exchanged his square-cut wig for a leather helmet.
"I wish you luck with it, my friend," he said. "I'm no magician, as you seem to be. But get me men, and I'll give you soldiers. That I can promise."
With a nod of farewell, he stepped out the door which opened onto the parade ground and joined the two aides who awaited him there. For a moment, Sheftu stood watching the ranks of copper-skinned foot soldiers file by the old general in the brilliant sunlight. They were few indeed. As the chariots bearing the archers followed, he could spot horses gone lame, damaged wheels, bareheaded men. Smiling grimly, he strode out of the building across the barracks yard and into the palace gardens by the nearest gate. When he emerged an hour later, it was with the jaunty step of a man whose time had not been wasted. He signaled a groom to fetch his chariot and stood savoring the fresh breeze and the thought of the interview just past, feeling more invigorated than he had for weeks. It was even possible he might enjoy Lord Mehrab's party on the morrow. A bald-pated little man in the garb of a priest appeared suddenly from nowhere, cast an idle look about him, then stopping a pace or two from Sheftu, stooped to adjust his sandal. Sheftu's heart gave a leap, and the party fled from his mind. He turned his back to the little man, but edged closer. He was rewarded by a whisper.
"Tomorrow, the hour of the fifth mark."
Baldpate vanished, leaving Sheftu staring casually into the middle distance with everything in him in an uproar. When his chariot arrived, he failed to notice it. Turning on his heel, he hurried into the labyrinth of palace gardens in search of Mara.
"There," murmured Inanni. "That lamb is finished now. Only one more, and the shawl will be done. What think you of it, Mara?"
At the other end of the garden bench, Mara interrupted her fascinated study of the ring on her finger to inspect the square of embroidery Inanni held up. She smiled. Inanni had worked a careful picture in colored threads, a green hillside dotted with lambs and a sleeping shepherd, with the square tower of a Syrian temple showing beyond.
"It is beautiful, my princess, but not so beautiful as the hill in my memory." Inanni sighed and plucked another skein of white wool from the workbasket. After a moment, Mara rose and strolled down to the pool in the center of the tiny garden, dropped down on the soft grass beside its rim, and once more fell to studying the ring. It was the heavy electrum band with the jeweled lotuses, the ring Sheftu had given her on the ship. She knew well it was dangerous folly to wear it, since it was supposed to have left her possession long ago, as a bribe for that friend in Abydos. One glimpse of it, and Sheftu would merely wait his moment to cut her throat. But how the eyes of those high and mighty palace servants had popped when they noticed it this morning. Mara grinned at the memory. It was worth a little danger to lord it over them occasionally, especially the supercilious butler who looked down his nose at her whenever he caught her slipping her sandals off. He would think twice next time about whom he snubbed. She turned the ring thoughtfully on her finger, wishing she had given in earlier to the temptation to put that butler in his place. For already she was convinced that the ring bore some potent charm. All morning, good luck had followed her, smoothed her way, made easy the most difficult situations. Think of this morning's audience with the king, if that was not luck.
"Mara," said Inanni suddenly, "someone is coming. It is the young nobleman of the Lotus Garden. Ah, would he not be handsome with a beard?"
Mara had swung around, spied Sheftu striding up the red graveled path, snatched the ring from her finger, and stuffed it into her sash before Inanni had finished speaking. Now she rose, brushed off her skirt with trembling hands, and sauntered forward as nonchalantly as she could.
"A beard?" she murmured. I had never thought of it, Highness."
It was all right. He couldn't have noticed that quick motion, and the folds of her sash concealed the hard little lump underneath it. She faced Sheftu composedly as he stopped before them, smiling.
"Princess, rejoice."
His long hand moved from his lips to his forehead in a gesture of careless grace.
"I bear Pharaoh's greetings. Her radiance inquires after the welfare of the Princess of Canaan."
For the first time in 4 days, his eyes had come alive. Something had happened. Mara translated hastily.
"Tell him I am content," Inanni murmured.
"She is content. What is it, Sheftu? Tell me, for the love of Amun."
"The signal has come. I have instructions for you. Say something to the princess."
"Highness, His Excellency wishes to know if..." "Mara?"
Inanni was facing her, an odd, nervous determination in her manner.
"I do not want to talk to this young man, nor does he want to talk to me. Please, will you not relieve me of the burden? I have an errand elsewhere."
"But, Highness..."
"Please, Mara."
Inanni put a hand on Mara's arm and looked her full in the eyes.
"The summer house yonder is empty, and no one comes here. You will be quite alone."
She snatched her workbasket from the bench and hurried across the garden and through the gate, leaving Mara staring after her.
"What is this?"
demanded Sheftu in a low voice.
"I don't know. Quite often lately she makes some excuse to slip away from me. I think she goes to see a Syrian woman in the court of the weavers. But it is strange that she would do that now."
Mara whirled back to him, suddenly excited.
"No matter. Should we question when Amun smiles on us? We're free to talk if you want to risk it. She spoke truth. No one comes here."
Sheftu flashed a quick glance around the garden, then took Mara's arm and hurried her toward the little summer house, which stood at the far end of the pool in a clump of acacia trees. It was a light wooden structure, little more than a stone platform and a roof. But vines clambered thick over its 3 latticed walls, and its open front faced a little away from the gate, so that once inside it, they could see without being seen. Mara sat down on a cushioned stool, looking about her with delight. All was cool green here, speckled with moving sunlight, little flakes and pellets of gold which sifted through the vines to dance agitatedly over Sheftu's white robes and her own and the painted floor, whenever the breeze stirred the leaves.
"Amun smiles indeed,"
murmured Sheftu, placing another stool where he could watch the gate.
"Something is bringing us good fortune."
Mara, aware of the hard little lump of the ring pressing against her waist, was quite sure she knew what that something was. But she said only,
"It's been a day of good fortune for me."
"What else has happened?"
"I've been longing to tell you. Bless Inanni for giving me the chance. We saw the king this morning, at last. As you know, I've been trying for 3 days.
Did he not say you could arrange for an audience whenever?
Aye, but it isn't as easy as it sounds. One has to find the proper chamberlain, tell him one lie, and Anani another. Sheftu cut her off impatiently, glancing toward the gate.
No matter. Say on, maid. The rest of it.
The rest was no easy task either. I had to give him your message somehow, with the room full of people. I know we sent them all away last time, but I suppose he didn't dare to do that twice, for fear of making them suspicious. They're all spies, Sheftu.
How do you know that?
From the way he glares at them. Mara shrugged, skipped nimbly over why the room had not been cleared, a feat which she had herself accomplished with no small difficulty, and hurried on. Be that as it may, they were all there, and I had to think fast, I promise you. It was Anani who saved me, she and the sketches.
Sketches?
Mara grinned, pausing a moment to enjoy his bewilderment. She was relishing the whole situation. The secluded little arbor, the danger, their lowered voices, and most of all, her secret amusement at how different this tale would sound when she told it to her master.
Aye, the sketches. They were all over the table when we came in the room. Sheets and scraps of papyrus and a clutter of pens and ink, and they were all drawings of vases.
Sheftu's face cleared.
Asked. The vases. They are a pastime of the king's. His hand is skilled with the artist's pen.
So Anani was saying when he walked into the room. If his highness has drawn these, Mara, then he is an artist of great talent. They are the most beautiful things I have seen in Egypt. And behold, there he stood, hearing every word. I know not which was the more surprised. Inani's cheeks rivaled the hues of her shawls.
Sheftu was grinning.
And was he flattered?
By my Ka, I believe he was. At least it caused him to think of her as a human being instead of a Syrian cow. For a moment I thought he was going to forget and speak to her in Babylonian, and then, alas, for Mara. But he stopped in time and bade me ask her which sketch she liked best.
Did he indeed?
Aye, and she picked one, though she was frightened out of her senses, and all her embroideries trembling. Mara pantomimed Inani's gesture, extending a timidly pointing finger and then jerking it away as if something had bitten it.
And then?
Chuckled Sheftu. He laughed, as you might guess, and folded his arms after his manner. Mara sat very erect, folded her own arms, and momentarily became the king.
Over-ornate, he said, and a little vulgar. Aye, well, being Syrian, she cannot help her taste. Tell her I will have it made up in yellow alabaster and delivered to her, with my compliments.
By Amun, it is well no one but myself sees you mimic him thus,
exclaimed Sheftu a little grimly.
You might forfeit that impudent tongue of yours.
Nay, I mean no impudence. I but tell you how it happened. Indeed, I'd not mock him, Sheftu. I was not but pleased by what he had done for my poor princess. Her face shone as if someone had lit a torch inside her. It has made her heart light all day, I think.
You seem fond of this barbarian,
observed Sheftu, leaning backward to peer cautiously toward the gate. It may be I am. I pity her, she is so lonely and homesick, and so far from home. Sheftu turned, a mixture of amusement and impatience on his face.
Do we risk our necks here to talk about the Canaanite? I would hear more of this lucky morning of yours.
Aye, you shall, but I crave a promise of you, Sheftu. When all this is finished, and the king wears his crown, will you send Inanni again to Canaan? Say you will. Her fate can mean naught to you, whether in Egypt or Syria.
She shall sail to the end of the world, if you like. But proceed with your story. What have the sketches to do with you?
I passed your message by means of them.
His promise gained, Mara was willing and eager to go on.
Aye, that was a fine bit of sleight of hand, though I praise my own wits. Remember the message.
He of the fan and he of the feather have come into our house.
Of course I know not what it signifies, added Mara innocently, though she had figured out long since that it meant the queen's fan-bearer and some other great noble, possibly a judge, whose symbol was the feather of truth, had been persuaded to swear allegiance to the king. But I wagered his highness would know well enough. I juggled the conversation with a skill that would have shamed Sahure until we spoke again of the sketches. Then I stepped forward, I so impulsively, and snatched a pen and drew a little design as a suggestion for some future vase. And lo, it was a fan and a feather, beside a house bearing the king's cartouche.
Very good indeed, said Sheftu, who had been grinning as he listened. A fine tale, and told by one who does not believe in ruining things with false modesty. I congratulate you, little one, on your cleverness, your sagacity, your...
Oh, hold your tongue. Could you have done better? He laughed softly, shaking his head.
Nay, perhaps not as well. I doubt if...
Suddenly his face went stiff with attention as the sound of voices drifted to them from somewhere just beyond the garden wall. He twisted for a quick glance toward the gate, then sprang up silently and pulled Mara with him to the dimmest corner of the summer house. As they stood there, flattened against the latticed wall, the voices grew more distinct, and footsteps crunched on the graveled path.
"Looked like a man who'd just seen a heft face to face," one voice was saying. "I do not jest, my friend. Something's happened between her radiance and the architect."
"He didn't speak to you?"
"Nay, he was in too much haste. He burst out of her chambers as if the devourer were after him, and went by me without a glance. I heard him snarling for his chariot outside, but I didn't stay to wave farewell. The climate's not healthy when he's in a rage."
"Aye, I hope he strangles on it," muttered the other.
"Last flood season he took 5 of my vineyards for crown property, by royal permission. But I note his slaves are cultivating them now." "He'll want the throne next, hark to my words, 10 years from now."
The voices faded as the two went out the other gate. Mara drew a long breath and glanced up at Sheftu, who seemed to have derived a great deal of malicious pleasure from what he had heard.
"Who was it?" she whispered.
"Two nobles who love Count Senmut as much as I," returned Sheftu dryly. "Count Hacheper, the one who talked about the vineyards. I believe I had best arrange a little conference with him sometime soon. Now look you, blue-eyed one, we must be out of here. I'll not be at the inn tonight, so you need not come. But tomorrow night..."
"It is tomorrow that..." Mara did not finish, but searched his face anxiously.
"Aye,"
he whispered.
"Tomorrow at the mark of 5, the messenger told me. It should be finished in 2 hours if all goes well."
"If all goes well," she repeated bitterly. He ignored that.
"So get thee to the tavern by the mark of 7, or as soon after as you are able. Is your Reshed still well bedazzled?"
"So I hope. He's tugging at his leash."
"Ah, you'll have no trouble. One so clever as you, so remarkable, so sagacious."
"Oh, leave off." But her scowl faded as he stood there laughing down at her, the sunflecks dancing crazily over his face and headcloth, and glinting into one jewel in his golden collar until it flashed like a star. "I'll be there, by his leave or without it," she murmured. "May the gods grant you will. Sheftu, take care."
"Little one, I'll do my best."
He guided her gently back to her stool.
"Sit here now and let the goldfish admire you a while. Give me about the count of 100. Farewell."
He slipped around the edge of the vine-clad wall and was gone. Mara could hear his footsteps on the gravel path, calm and unhurried. She did not look up, fixing her attention instead on the fat red goldfish drifting lazily in and out between the lotus stems in the depths of the pool. It would never do to think of where he was going,
what he must do before she saw him again, if she ever did. By the time she had counted the goldfish three times over, the garden had been empty for some time. She rose, went out into the glare of afternoon, and walked slowly across the garden toward the palace. Part 5. The Ring. Chapter 16. The Gamble. The servants were laying the tables in the yellow-paneled dining room of the princess's suite before Anani returned from her mysterious errand, and by that time Mara had thought long and uneasily about her absence. What did she really know of Anani, save that she was homesick and unhappy? Very little, or the princess's sudden withdrawal this afternoon would not have taken her so by surprise. Mara did not like surprises. The moment had arrived, she reflected, to converse in private with Anani. Accordingly, as soon as the meal was over and the Syrian women, still licking honey from their plump fingers, had wandered into the big sitting room to chatter or do needlework, Mara invited the princess to view the sunset with her from the roof pavilion. A few minutes later, they were emerging onto the breeze-swept loggia. Above them, the sky flamed with sunset, trailing scarlet banners of cloud and tinging with pink the myriad white walls and buildings of the city spread out below. Even the Nile looked like a river of fire, set between banks of unnaturally vivid green. "Beautiful!" exclaimed Anani, as they stood at the balustrade looking out upon it all. But there was a note of dismay in her voice, and she soon retreated to a couch under the partial shelter of one of the painted awnings. Mara, who was accustomed to the violent beauty of Egypt, lingered a moment to feast her eyes on it. "It is very different," she said softly, "from the sunsets of Canaan, I suppose. Aye, everything there seems softer, and the hills thrust up to hide part of the sky so that it does not seem so huge and fiery, and one does not feel so small. Mara, perhaps it is not wise to talk of Canaan." "Very well," said Mara firmly, turning around to her. "Then let us talk of something else. My princess, why did you leave me in the garden today?"
"Why, because I had an errand."
Inanni's great dark eyes met Mara's, and their expression changed.
"So be it," she said quietly. "It was because of what I told you, Mara. That young man did not want to talk to me, nor I to him. He was seeking you."
After a moment, Mara left the balustrade and sat down on the other end of the couch.
"How long have you known this?"
"Since the day I first saw him in the Lotus Garden.
Mara, I know other things, too. I know the king has no interest in me, nor ever will. And when I have audience with him, he does not speak of the things you say he does. There is a great trouble of some sort here, and I have somehow become part of it. Forgive me, I did not even mean to tell you of this, but today I suddenly... It seemed too burdensome to go through again. I should not have spoken of it, though."
"Why not? Why didn't you tell me long ago?"
"Well, I felt it would be easier for you if I pretended I knew nothing, so that you would not be troubled about that part of it. But I fear I am very poor at pretending. Forgive me if I have spoiled everything now."
Mara sat silent, wonderingly studying the plump, anxious face before her.
"It is you who must forgive me, my princess," she said at last. "You have shown me exactly how clever I have been."
She got up and walked to the balustrade again, but this time she did not see the red sky and the thousand roofs of Thebes. Inanni had been sorry for her. For her. It was a strange sensation, entirely new in her experience, and bewildering. She wondered, in some astonishment, if she were going to cry, then decided that by rights she should be laughing, hard, laughing at herself. She turned to Anani and knew suddenly that she wanted to tell her everything, tumble out the whole story and plead for understanding.
to take down the bars just once and let another human being in. "Do you want to hear the rest?" she heard herself saying in a small voice. "If you want to tell me, Mara." "I do, but it's mad. They'll kill me if they find out."
Inanni's cheeks grew pale, but she spoke quietly. "They will never find out from me, Mara."
"It would matter to no one, save myself," said Mara with bitterness. "I'm not but a slave. All my fine clothes and my heirs are borrowed property. Not 4 weeks ago, I was starching shenties and stealing bread from the baker's boys in Menfi."
Mara walked back to the couch, kicked off her sandals defiantly, and curled her feet under her. "And getting thrashed for it, as always. The whole thing began, for me, that day. A stranger in a white cloak came into my master's courtyard. It was easy once she started. She talked rapidly, though in a low voice, explaining her sale, the astonishing interview with her master afterward, her meeting with Sheftu on the beetle, and all that had happened since. Inanni's dark eyes grew round with wonder, excitement, and anxiety as she listened. Beyond them, over Thebes, the wild red banners in the sky faded to murky rose, and the east darkened, but neither of them knew it.
"So it is a revolution," whispered Inanni at last. "Aye, and here I am, tangled in both sides of it. At first all seemed simple. I had but to mention Sheftu's name to my master, and he would shower me with gold, give me my freedom. But now," Mara hesitated, then added reluctantly, "of course, naught is different now. I could mention it still." "But you do not want to now," said Inanni softly. "Nay, I do not want to now. I am a fool, am I not?"
Inanni shook her head.
"You are in love with this Lord Sheftu."
Denial sprang to Mara's lips and died there as her gaze encountered Inanni's. She ended by shrugging wearily, leaning back against the cushions.
"Little good it does me. He thinks me a gutter snipe and says so, and tomorrow..."